The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, this morning on News Talk, we're delighted to be joined exclusively by the newly appointed Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces. He joined the forces in 1986, and Lieutenant General Sean Clancy became the first Air Corps member to reach the rank of Chief of Staff when he replaced Vice Admiral Mark Mellett upon Mark's retirement. And Lieutenant General Sean Clancy is with me now in studio. Good morning and welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Pat. Delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
It's great to meet someone from the Air Corps who made it all the way up. It is not just unusual, it's unique.
Thanks, Pat. Yeah, it is unique. And I'm very conscious that I'm hugely privileged, actually, if I can say it in that regard, to be the first airman. With that comes responsibilities and duties. But I'm no different to any other soldier, sailor or air crew member in the Defence Force as a whole. We commit ourselves to service. And as I said, I'm very, very conscious of the privilege and very humbled by the fact that I'm the first airman to be in this role. Okay.
And no doubt your colleagues in the Air Corps will be looking for great things from you in terms of equipment supply, updating everything, making sure that people don't leave to join Ryanair and Aer Lingus. And that's both the mechanics as well as the air crew.
Well, I have a big smile on my face there. It's like having your own children. You probably treat your own children, you know, hardest on a team and you're hardest on them than you are in any. And I think similarly, you know, I'm, you know, agnostic, I suppose, in terms of my commitment to the Defence Forces, first and foremost. And where there
there'll be no favourite child.
Absolutely no favourite child. And I think every service, land, sea and air, have their own unique challenges. And my duty is to respond to those challenges as I see fit.
Now, your own track record, I mean, you spent a lot of time as a search and rescue pilot. And yourself and your crew got the Marine Medal for Meritorious Service in 2002. What did you have to do?
Well, yes, as you rightly say, I spent the bulk of my career in terms of my operational career in the flying environment. I was a search and rescue pilot as well as many other things, of course. That particular medal was awarded to a crew where, you know, we did search and rescue by day and by night without any assistance from night goggles or anything of technology wise in those days. And we used a Dolphin helicopter. And I was with a great crew on a particular day. Brendan Jackman was my co-pilot. Flight Sergeant Dave Carlin, who has sadly passed on, was probably the best winch operator I've ever worked with. And he was with me, fortunately, that day. And with a young, new winchman, Benny Meehan was his name. We were tasked out to north of Sleeve League in Donegal. Sleeve League are the highest cliffs there in the Donegal Bay area. And just north of that, on the other side, out west of Ardra, there was a couple who wandered off the pathways and got down into the cliff area and couldn't get back. It looked like a very benign day to us from an operational point of view. We went out, but of course, there was a very strong wind that was coming from the south over Sleeve League and created huge disruptive air on the other side. Now, if anybody knows anything about helicopters, you need clear air, and smooth air gives you the best effect.
Sure.
So ultimately, we had huge trouble getting into the that couple. The helicopter had to work at its extreme. We had to put Benny out in an abnormal position. We normally put them out in a safe area and then walk into the cliff. However, in this case, we had to put him out at extreme heights.
Now, Benny was the
winchman.
Now,
on the rope.
No, the dope on the rope is how you guys describe.
That is a term that has often been used and it's commonly used. And it's
because he's the guy who goes down. He's winched down.
Correct.
And I've often spoken to Air Corps people over the years because we did air shows and all that, which I covered with the Air Corps and enjoyed those experiences very much. But the idea of lowering someone, say, onto a ship in the middle of the ocean, a turbulent ocean, and you've got to try and get in sync with the rise and fall of vessel, or else you'll be whacked by the deck up at you.
That's great. Look, and we were very conscious of that. The dope on the rope is a term of endearment, actually.
Yes, of course, and
nothing else but. But that day we had to put him out in the open space, out over the water and climb. But the difficulty we had, we couldn't hold a helicopter, and I couldn't hold a helicopter for any prolonged period of time. And we had to fall away many times to find a sweet spot, as we call it, to get at the couple. It was very, very difficult in the end, very hazardous position. I think we were working in the extremes of our skill sets, if you like, all of us. But in the end, we managed to get the couple away. We put them down very close to where they had left from, near their car. They were very grateful. We came back, of
course. Don't tell me they fell down again.
No, they didn't. We came back, had our tea and shook out and said, we, you know, agreed, all of us, we were really on the edge there. But to the man, we knew that was our job. And anytime you go out on a mission, it's dangerous. Now, we didn't actually report it or the difficulties. It was the Marine Rescue Coordination Centre in Malinhead. They recognised through the communications and then the debriefs that we afterwards have, as we normally would with them. And they actually wrote everything up and submitted it to the Department of Marine, recommending that we should be recognised for that particular mission. Mm. And, you know, we were very grateful, and it is a nice. But, you know, everybody and every rescue and every search and rescue to this day, provided by the Coast Guard, of course, very competently, you know, there is risk involved, and we accept that, and it's in the nature of it. And I accept it, and all the team did. So that was the incident or the mission that revolved in it, you know, at that time.
Many of our listeners might have travelled in helicopters, you know, sightseeing helicopters and so on. The kind of machines that you fly are relations of those kind of helicopters. Yeah. But helicopters generally, I mean, they actually want to self-destruct. It's only good engineering that keeps them together.
You're quite right. I mean, it's abnormal to see a helicopter flying, one would say. But technology has advanced so much, and the redundancies on systems on board the aircraft, the numbers of engines, the reliabilities of engines are so, so good nowadays. And the training is excellent with the use of simulations and so on and so forth, that, you know, it's a hugely reliable and safe method of transport, actually.
In 2012, the aeromedical unit of the Air Corps was set up?
That's right. I was very involved in that, actually. I was one of myself, as the unit commander at the time, proposed a case forward that we could do something in this area, because there were challenges around, and particularly the access of patients in the Midlands and in, say, North Mayo, Roscommon, Monaghan areas, immediate access. And with a colleague in the National Ambulance Service, Professor Cathal O'Donnell, now Professor Cathal O'Donnell, he had experience in Canada, and we kind of got talking around this issue. Yeah. And we made a proposal because he saw the need. I saw the need in terms of a raison d'etre, if you like, in terms of the unit and the outputs that we were doing. And it was compatible with the contingency that we had in terms of skill sets that would enable us to actually exercise those skill sets. It's been a hugely successful. It was done on a pilot basis originally and then formally put in place by the government later in 2015. But last year, you know, they had over 3,000 cases of the people that were assisted and lifted from greenfield sites, road traffic accidents. And the primary, I suppose, role of it was to get people to the centre of excellence on time to get the best outcomes for the patients.
Yeah. I mean, that's the advantage of a helicopter over fixed wing. You need a certain amount of space and a little bit of clear air to get down, but you can get close to where you want to
Absolutely.
Be.
Absolutely. And you have flexibility. And you have to mitigate all of the risks that are associated with that, of course. Fields of wires in them.
Sure.
You know, roads are difficult. Surfaces aren't even, and so on and so forth. But with training and with skills and with proper protocols, you know, this has turned out to be a hugely successful actual tasking for the Air Corps.
I don't know whether they approached you guys when they were designing the Children's Hospital in St. James's, because we're told that it won't be able to take the heavy-duty choppers.
I don't know if that's the case. I'll be straight up with you. Certainly the space in St. James's isn't there for it. And rooftop landings for helicopters above a certain size are extremely difficult.
Yeah. Because these are big machines.
These are big, big machines. Some of the smaller helicopter types are compatible with rooftop landings, but you have to reinforce and you have to plan ahead in order to put, you know, anything bigger than that on it. And some of the bigger helicopters simply cannot operate. Yeah.
I'm not sure whether they still have this, but you remember the old Pan Am building in New York?
Yes.
And there were often pictures of it, and it had a helipad on the top. I don't know whether they use that. I think they use, down by the East River, they have a helipad there.
That particular rooftop accident, that there was an accident off that rooftop in Pan Am building at that time, and that triggered a huge review of rooftop landings, in particular in America. And that's what triggered the actual river
East River based.
East River based, that was put in place afterwards. Mm. And it was a kind of a catalyst, I suppose, to that type of thinking in terms of safety and helicopter safety. And the use of helicopters in built up areas became very much a focal point of safety.
One of the most scary things I've ever experienced was flying in a sightseeing helicopter over Manhattan, over the skyscrapers. And literally, people were like ants down below. And because of the buildings and the fact that we were just flying over them, you get a sense of your own mortality when you're up there.
I hope they kept you close to the river, though, Pat, did they? Because you need a, you need an out when you're over those buildings. You
what
need
do they call it
route.
When if your engine goes and you,
you auto rotate?
Auto rotate, and you hope that that'll get you down. As you fall, it forces the rotors to keep turning.
Correct, yeah. No, that's if you've only one engine, of course. You would hopefully have two engines on a machine and therefore the second one will get you to the safe place of your landing, you know, or will get you safely to the crash site.
I think we're putting people off flying in choppers.
I hope not, but I reassure people that it is a very, very safe mode of transport and, you know, and I have a huge confidence in the skill sets that and the professionalism of our Air Corps crews in operating now, our helicopters.
As well as, obviously, all your operations in the air, you've had other roles. I mean, you were in Bosnia, for example.
Yes, I mean, I've had roles in Defence Headquarters and strategic planning. I've had roles in our information area, and I spent over a year in Bosnia as the military advisor to the force commander. I also spent 2 years as closely associated with the permanent planning element of the UN Standby Brigade, which gave me a huge opportunity to travel as the air advisor in terms of Scandinavia, but more importantly, to contribute to the work being done to create sustainability and resilience in forces in the African Union. So I visited Kenya and the Congo and those areas where we did, where I participated in what they call command post exercises. But my Bosnia trip was probably the most focal point of my overseas experience, if you like.
Now, your job as the Commander-in-Chief of the Defence Forces is to run all the services. Let's talk about maybe one difficulty, first of all, retention of people, because we're told that our army officers are so well trained that they're in high demand. Once they reach a point where they can retire early from the force, they're gone.
Yeah, I mean, the question of retention and recruitment actually are often used in the same sentence, if you like, Pat. And I'm very, very confident in terms of our capacity to recruit, and that's shown over the last 5 years. We've, you know, recruited more people than we probably have in any year past and previous to that. My previous role as DCOS support, I'm very conscious of, in particular, the challenges and the problems we have around retention. And some of those you've enlightened us on in terms of, and they're factually correct. Retention is a huge challenge for the organisation, in particular, in as you mentioned, the specialist skill sets where we have to develop our people. I won't apologise for, you know, developing our personnel to the highest levels. And we have both officers and enlisted, you know, commissioned and non-commissioned officers in the skill sets, because we have demands for capabilities to deliver, and we have to develop our people to a standard and people give back all of the time for periods of time or for the entirety of their careers, in fact. Retaining people is a challenge, and we've introduced an awful lot of, I suppose, initiatives over the last couple of years, in particular when I was in DCOS support, areas around re-entry and recommissioning. Like, we have put a framework in place to recommission people that have left the organisation but have a desire to come back and give back. This is the first time in the history that we have actually put a framework around that. And that's been successful in terms of commissioned officers coming back into specialist areas like pilots, like engineers, like ordnance officers. And in the non-commissioned and re-enlistment, we've put a structure around that under the last minister, which, you know, we had a level of ambition of 100 people, and we're just shy of that now in terms of actually accomplishment. So we're close to our target.
What about the ordinary enlisted man or woman? And, you know, from time to time on radio programs, you get people phoning in saying, we can't live, we need social assistance, the pay is not good enough. Now, I grew up beside GHQ on Infirmary Road, so very familiar with the army life way back in the day when army provided accommodation, which is not much the case anymore.
Yeah, no, the policy around accommodation has been has no longer exist for quite a period of time, and it would be certainly something that would be desirable, but it is not there in effect. Pay is always, and remuneration is always an issue, and I understand that in terms of it, and I will advocate towards, you know, enhancing the remuneration of those of my people, in particular the specialists that we train and develop and we want to retain. The wider issue, of course, for me is around actually the value piece and the added value and the total value package that we give to our personnel. And when I speak about that, I'm talking about the total, say, the health insurance area and the health area and what we provide. And there should be quality of that throughout our services. And when you put all of that in, and the minister himself and the government have put it down in their planning and the government plan with regards to getting that level level of health insurance and that, and the total rewards package is important for all of our people, because so that you can complement and meet the challenges that you've alluded to in terms
of personnel. Think of the people who lived in McKee Barracks, Collins Barracks and so on, who had if you like accommodation there, and there was family accommodation in some of the barracks, and then when they retired at whatever age, generally they could avail of an ample supply of social housing from the local authorities. Of course, that route is gone now, and you've got army personnel having to pay sometimes exorbitant rents with the help of HAP and so on. But it does seem to be a kind of a demeaning situation where they can't afford to house themselves comfortably.
The family accommodation is probably gone with some time now, Pat. Yeah. And let me be clear, we still do accommodate people, especially our new entrants. We provide them with accommodation, our new officers and enlisted, and we provide them with accommodation during training and for a considerable amount of period after they train. And we have a huge stock of accommodation, if you like, for our, you know, our single people and our trainees and our and those that need to be accommodated. We don't have family accommodation per se of any substance left in the organisation.
Because down the corner, for example, it was like a town with the school and with the families and all the rest of it. And that's all changed.
But the corner is a town. It is a military installation with a town associated with it, if you like. It's the model has changed significantly, Pat, and that's just how the economy, how society has evolved and developed over time. The social housing challenge is a wider societal challenge in Ireland, and that's just the way it is.
Now, the various challenges that you face will be clarified, I think, by the report on the commission which the minister has established. You expect that report very soon to outline the direction in which the armed forces will go and to what use they will be put.
Yes, we expect, and the commission is due to report at the end of the year. As you know, the minister set up the commission at the end of last year, and there was a 12-month period that was set down for reporting. It's my understanding at this time from the commission and the chair himself that he still has that level of ambition in terms of delivering the report. Once that report is delivered, it will go to government, of course, and they will accept the recommendations, and they will review the recommendations and accept those which they see fit to accept. And thereafter, we will set down a roadmap in terms of implementation of that report. I have a high level of expectation in terms of ambition that will come from that commission. I think I speak confidently that the minister also shares that level of ambition, and he's on the record of saying he has a level of ambition. It's a difficult task that the commission has, and they have visited nearly every installation in the defence forces. I've engaged and the general staff have engaged on several occasions, and I will look forward to next week where we'll have our final engagement, and I lead my team into engaging with the commission, and at that time I lay out a number of principles in terms of what I see as kind of important to the defence forces in terms of their final considerations.
I mean, that they may say you don't need all the installations you have. It's time to, you know, get rid of them, dispose of them for housing or whatever. That you may be the chief of staff of cuts and downsizing.
Well, I'm certainly not looking at it through that lens, Pat. The commissioner focused on three key areas: capabilities, structures and staffing. And with that will come a level of expectation in terms of how we deliver that. Infrastructure is one part of that delivery system. We're looking at a fit for purpose defence forces. And I think the state requires it and demands that. And we've seen that through our recent COVID and so on and so forth. And when we went to Kabul, you can see the purposefulness that is within the defence forces. I think the commission also understand that. And whatever requirements and whatever shape that takes, there's going to be a transformational change in the defence forces to bring us into the 2030 and beyond.
I mean, to be a modern high-tech army, you've obviously got to get experience being deployed. The United Nations offers those opportunities, but also the Rapid Reaction Force and things like that. And working not as part of NATO, but in cooperation with NATO, people get confused about how a neutral country can do all of that.
They do, but I mean, fundamentally, as you probably have heard before, we're tied into the triple lock, which demands a UN-mandated mission in the first instance. And Ireland's foreign policy is directed focused on the UN-mandated mission. It's also focused on multilateralism and a multilateral approach. And that's where Ireland, and through the defence forces in some instances, contribute to that comprehensive approach. And in order to be fit for purpose for that, the defence forces, you know, have to be ready. And we have in many areas in terms of UN missions, we have it in Mali. And this can be either a EU mission, of course, and a UN mission. EU is very focused on sustainability and on capacity building, if you will. And we have forces out in Mali. We have them in Bosnia, as you already mentioned, where I have served. We had Pontus in the Mediterranean, and now, which is now morphed into Irini, and several other missions that we're involved in. And of course, we have UN missions as well. So, and some of them are actually co-joined. Our Partnership for Peace is a kind of a partner with NATO, but it's not part of NATO. And that facilitates us under UN mandate to be able to, I suppose, learn, develop, and become more interoperable because of the standards and the learnings we can have that are provided through NATO.
And we know that Ireland has a very good reputation internationally as part of UN forces deployed pretty much all around the world, and long may that continue. One of the things you probably didn't want to have on your desk as you took over the job was the, for a shorthand, the Women of Honour issue. What are you doing going forward to handle that?
I've taken several steps, Pat, and you know, the Women of Honour is an area I was deeply concerned when I heard that programme. I was hugely motivated by the courage shown by the Women of Honour, you know.
For people who don't know, it's about sexual harassment within the ranks.
It covers a broad spectrum of behavioural approaches and behavioural attitudes, right up to misogyny and sexual assault and sexual inappropriate sexual behaviours. So I see it as a whole spectrum, actually, of addressing a culture within the organisation. Can I say on the record as well, and I've said it and I think it's appropriate I say it today also, that everybody in the Defence Forces, irrespective of their gender, their race, their religion, or their sexual orientation, has the unconditional right to respect and dignity in the workplace. Everybody should be able to come to the workplace energised and feeling valued. It's clear. I have listened in the last three and a half weeks to the women in the Defence Forces and to minority groups within the Defence Forces and to some men in the Defence Forces, and listened to their stories. And I'm hugely motivated and take ownership of the fact that we have to change the behavioural issues that have allowed this pervasive situation to develop. I should also say that I can speak confidently for the majority of men and women in the Defence Forces who find this type of behaviour abhorrent. And that is very clear from my engagements with people. And it's also very clear that those that I'm speaking to and confidentially and listening to and hearing to and what they want to change. And I'm set to do that. We have a number of things, of course. The Minister has announced a confidential line, the confidential contact person, but also internally I've set up a team that are focused on internal communication, on education and training, and in delivering response, an immediate response team to go out and to remind and develop the climate and the culture that is positive within an organisation, to remind commanders how that is achieved.
Lieutenant General Sean Clancy, newly appointed Chief of Staff of the Irish Defence Forces, thank you very much for joining us in studio today.
Pat, you're most welcome. Thank you.